of Russian opposition forces ammunition to use against the government, which is already fighting for its life. The admiral apologized, said it was an accident, and offered to talk directly to the Russians. His offer was rejected. Then he asked what the White House was doing about the NR1. Strangely, the president and his people had forgotten to tell Sandecker the sub was missing. Paul grinned and said, assuming the admiral wouldn't know was pretty dumb on their part. Gamay shook her head. It's unbelievable that the NR1 could vanish with no trace, as if it had been swallowed by a sea monster. You're not far off the mark. The NR1 was hijacked and transported on the deck of a submarine. That's more far-fetched than the sea monster theory, Gamay said. We were trying to figure things out when Kurt called and said a source had told him that a mining tycoon named Mikhail Ratsov is behind the political unrest in Russia. According to the White House, there's a tie between the NR1's disappearance and the mess in Moscow. In addition, Ratsov's company, Ataman Enterprises, has leased the sub-base from the Russian government. Gamay said, that's why Kurt asked us to look into Ratsov's operation at Novorossiysk. You think the NR1 was taken to this old sub-base, Paul said. We thought that was a possibility, but we were more worried about something else, Kurt's source said, that Ratsov was connected to a plot against the United States. What sort of plot? Paul asked. We don't know. Sandecker considered the tip serious. When Kurt said he was assembling the special assignments team and planned to go back to the base, the admiral gave his unofficial blessing. Kurt must have mentioned that his mission was unofficial. He put it quite colorfully, Gamay said, laughingly. I won't even ask, said Rudy, imagining Austin's report. The White House specifically warned Admiral Sandecker to stay clear of the NR1 investigation. I'm sure it won't surprise you to know he managed to get around that warning by a technicality. He agreed not to search for the sub, but said nothing about the sub base. I'm shocked, shocked, Gamay said, with mock horror, echoing Casablanca. Me too, said Paul. Who would have thought such a thing? Your sarcasm is dutifully noted and ignored. But you get the point. We had to keep the admiral insulated to give him room to maneuver. Risky, Paul said. The whole thing could blow up in Newman's face. Sandecker was well aware of that possibility, but the gods who watch over the Black Sea were in a benevolent mood. You look like the cat who swallowed the canary, Gamay said, noting Gunn's enigmatic smile. Apparently Kurt has some good news. Very good. He and Joe found the NR1's crew. The package I mentioned. They were being held captive at the Russian base. They're on the Argo now. That's great, but I don't understand, Paul said, furrowing his brow. The Russians were holding them prisoner? It's more complicated than that, from what I gather. The captain and pilot are still missing, along with the sub itself. Kurt wanted us all to be at the crew's debriefing. Finding these guys is quite a coup for Numa and the admiral, Paul observed. Unfortunately, we can't claim credit for the rescue. I'm not sure how it will be announced, since no one has ever told the public of the hijacking. The top brass has been keeping the sub's hijacking a secret. Hard to keep a secret in Washington, Paul said. The story is bound to get out. I agree. We've notified the Navy that we found the sub's crew, but we've deliberately been short on details. We won't be able to get away with that strategy forever, which is why this brainstorming session with the crew is so important. We've got to get to the bottom of this. Why don't we help ourselves to more coffee while you fill me in on your encounter with Ataman? Gamay volunteered to refill their coffee mugs. I'll let Paul do the play-by-play, and I'll add the color, she said. Gunn listened to their story without interrupting. From experience, they knew that Gunn would absorb every detail. His analytical skills were legendary. He had been the first in his class at the U.S. Naval Academy, had formerly held the rank of commander, and before he became second in command to Sandecker, had overseen logistics and oceanographic projects for Numa. Gunn peppered them with questions after they finished their tale. He was particularly interested in Boris, the mad monk, and in Yuri's comment about the absence of the big drilling ships. Adaman's violent reaction was simple to explain. Ratzov had something to hide and didn't like people snooping around. But Boris and the missing drilling ships didn't fit into any equation he could formulate. He sat back in his seat, adjusted the horn-rimmed glasses on his hawkish nose, and tented his fingers, much as Sherlock Holmes would have been absorbed by a puzzle. All he needed to complete the picture was a pipe and a deerstalker's cap. The pilot's voice broke Gunn's concentration. "We're coming up on the Argo, folks. If you look off to the right, you'll see the ship." The Argo had switched on every light and greeting and looked like a giant floating Christmas tree against the inky darkness of the sea. The helicopter hovered over the ship and slowly descended onto the large, blinking X that marked the landing pad. The touchdown was nearly perfect, marked by a slight thump of the wheels on the deck. The rotors spun to a stop, and the co-pilot came back to open the door. The passengers thanked the crew for a smooth flight and descended the boarding steps, eyes blinking against the brilliant floodlights that turned the night into day. Austin's broad shoulders and pale hair were easy to spot among the crowd that had gathered to greet the arrivals. He strode over, shook hands with Gunn, and put his arms around the Trouts. "Hope you had time for your martinis," Austin said. Gimay smiled and pecked his cheek. "We squeezed in two drinks apiece, thank you. Sorry to drag you out here so soon after your Novorossiysk trip." He guided them to the mess hall and brought them three tinkling glasses of fresh-squeezed lemonade. "Joe's babysitting the crew in the conference room. We're meeting with them in 15 minutes to hear their story. The crew is anxious to get home, and I've asked them to give us an hour while the chopper fuels up." Gunn puckered his lips in amusement as Austin filled them in on the crew's rescue. "I don't mean to demean the dangers you described, Kurt, but it sounds like a Pink Panther movie with all those people running around." "I was thinking more of the Keystone Cops," Austin said. "Someday I'll look back and chuckle over the whole crazy episode." He brushed his head lightly with his fingers. "But if my hair could have gotten any whiter, it would have." "I'm intrigued by this Russian you call Ivan," Gunn said. "How do you know him?" "Our paths crossed when I was working for the CIA." "Is he a friend or foe?"
"I'd call him a friend for the moment. I suspect that he'll do pretty much what he thinks is in the best interests of Russia. He is devious and shrewd, and he didn't survive all those purges in Russian intelligence by being a choir boy."
"That's quite a resume. Despite his checkered background, you think we should trust him?"
"For now.
And for one very good reason."
"What's that?" Gunn said.
"He's all we've got."
Chapter 19. The soggy bunch Captain Kamal had rescued from the sea and transferred to the Argo was gone. In their place was a happy band of submariners who could laugh about their ordeal, which was what they were doing when Austin and the others arrived at the conference room. After boarding the Argo, the NR-1 crew had been checked out by the ship's medical technician, filled with extraordinary meals from the galley, and given the loan of Numa work coveralls. Except for scratches and bruises, the men in the conference room showed few visible effects from their ordeal. Sitting at the metal table that occupied center place were Captain Atwood, Ensign Kreisman, and Joe Zavala. Joe smiled broadly when he saw his Numa colleagues come through the door. He rose and went over to shake hands with Gunn and Trout. Ever the ladies' man, he gave Gamay a kiss on the cheek. After a quick round of introductions, Austin announced, to claps and whistles, "In a few hours you'll be back in Istanbul, where a jet is waiting to fly you home. Your relatives have been notified that you're safe. More applause.
You must be anxious to be on your way, but I've got a favor to ask. We've only heard parts of your remarkable story. While the chopper is fueling up for the return trip, I'm hoping you can tell us what happened from start to finish.
Ensign Kreisman stood and said, "It's the least we can do. I'm sure I speak for the crew when I say thanks to you and Joe for getting us out of that place in one piece.
Remind us to bring a Bradley fighting vehicle the next time," Austin said. He waited for the laughter to die down.
"If you don't mind, Ensign, I'll play Perry Mason. I think it will go faster that way."
"No problem, sir."
"Good. Why don't you start from the beginning?"
Kreisman took a position in front of a wall chart that showed the Eastern Aegean.
"Our mission was to dive on underwater archaeological sites off the Turkish coast.
Here." He tapped the map.
"In addition to our regular crew under the command of Captain Logan, we carried a guest scientist who called himself Dr. Joseph Pulaski, supposedly from MIT.
Gunn raised his hand.
"Point of information. After we learned the sub was hijacked, we went over the roster and found Pulaski's name. When we checked with MIT, they said they'd never heard of him."
"Too bad we didn't check before he came on board," the ensign said with a shake of his head.
"In any event, the mission was an unqualified success. We retrieved some artifacts with our manipulator capacity. We were preparing the surface when Pulaski pulled a gun. Most of the crew was aft of the control room and didn't see it happen. The captain informed us, so in the intercom. He ordered us to stay put or Pulaski would shoot us. The sub went up a few hundred feet and hovered."
"For how long?" Austin said.
"About 25 minutes.
Then a huge shadow appeared in the monitors. It looked like a whale or shark coming up under the sub. And then there was a horrendous clang. The sub shook so hard, anyone who wasn't holding on was thrown to the floor. Next we heard a scraping and clawing as if big metal beetles were crawling around on the outside of the hull.
Divers. We could see them on the monitors.
One clown even waved at the camera. Next thing we knew, the divers were gone and we were flying through the ocean."
"Where were the captain and pilot and the other scientist during all of this?" Austin asked.
"In the control room."
"Did the captain say anything more?"
"Yes, sir. He said to send coffee and sandwiches forward."
"What was the support ship doing at this time?"
"We heard them calling on the radio until Pulaski ordered all communications shut down. I assume they tracked us until we were out of range."
"How long did you travel underwater?" Austin asked.
"A matter of hours. When we surfaced, it was as dark as Hades. Not a light to be seen anywhere. Then armed men came down the hatch into the NR-1.
Russians?
"We couldn't tell, although I think they were carrying AK-47s. They were wearing camo and acted like professional soldiers. Not like those jerks on horseback that you saved us from. They kept their mouths shut. Pulaski did all the talking. He told us to get out of the NR-1. We climbed out onto the deck of a big sub."
"Any idea on the sub's length?" Gunn said.
Kreisman looked around the room. "Anyone want to take a stab at a guess?"
Another seaman spoke up.
"I served on a boomer when I first joined the Navy. Judging from its beam, around 30 feet, I'd estimate this baby was as long as Los Angeles class, about 360 feet. The NR-1 is only 150 feet long.
They could easily piggyback you with more than 200 feet to spare," Austin said.
The sailor nodded.
"That sub was bigger than our support vessel."
Austin glanced around the room. "Anyone see markings?"
Nobody responded.
"Too dark and no moon," Kreisman explained.
"So they moved you into the big sub?"
"Correct. They locked us in a bunk room. Not enough beds for all of us, so we took turns sleeping. They brought food from time to time. We submerged for 24 hours. When we surfaced again, it was night. The ocean was different from the Aegean. The air didn't have the saltiness we'd been used to. More like one of the Great Lakes.
"Tell them about the ship sounds we heard before that," one of the submariners said.
"Sorry, I forgot about that. It was a while before we surfaced. The bunk room was as quiet as a grave. Some of the guys in the bunks said they could hear the sound of ship engines through the bulkheads. We all put our ears up to the hull and listened. It was true."
"You were in an area of heavy ship traffic?"
"That's what we figured. Eventually the noise died out. Several hours later, we came up next to a surface ship. It must have been waiting for us. They hustled us onto the ship and into another bunk room. That was our home sweet home for 3 days."
"They kept you there all that time?" Gunn said.
"Hell no. Early the next morning, we were assembled on the deck. Guys with guns kept us covered, and the big sub was nowhere to be seen. Pulaski was there. He gave us that creepy smile of his. 'Good morning, gentlemen,' Christman imitated Pulaski's accent. 'In return for this delightful cruise, we are going to ask that you do a little job for us.' He said we would be salvaging material from an old ship. Pulaski and another thug were going with us. So we piled into the NR-1 alongside the ship, which was acting as our tender, and down we went."
"How deep?"
400 feet plus. No big deal for the NR-1. We noticed the water buoyancy was different. We needed less ballast to bring us down. The sea bottom was mud for the most part, sloping before it abruptly dropped off into the deep. The wreck sat on the bank of an underwater canyon or valley that ran at right angles to the cliff face.
Was there a name on the ship's hull?
None that we could see. The vessel was covered with seaweed and barnacles. The bow was more up and down than raked, like those pictures you see of the Titanic. He used his hand to demonstrate.
What was its position on the bottom?
The ship sat on the slope, leaning over at a sharp angle. It looked as if a good shove would tip it over. We saw a big hole in the starboard side.
Could you see inside the hole?
It was filled in with rubble. We only stayed there a minute. They were more interested in the other side. They had fitted out the manipulator arm with a cutting torch. We touched down on the slanting deck. It was pretty dicey, putting the sub down at an angle. We had the feeling the ship could roll over at any time. Then they told us to cut a hole in the superstructure.
"Not in the hold?" Austin said with surprise.
"That's where the cargo would be."
"You'd think so, but we weren't in a position to argue. We made an opening around 10 by 10 feet. It wasn't too hard. The metal was old and rusted. We had to be careful, though. It was like a surgical operation. One nudge and the ship would drop off into the deep. We were all aware of that. We could see the old bunks and mattresses." Pulaski and his buddy got real agitated. They started to jabber over some diagrams of the wreck that they had with them.
In Russian.
Sounded like it.
Apparently they'd had us cut through the wrong spot. We tried 2 more times before they found what they wanted. It was a fairly big cabin filled with metal boxes the size of those old steamer trunks you see in antique shops.
How many boxes?
About a dozen, jumbled every which way. Pulaski told us to grab them with the NR-1's manipulator arm. We had a tough time moving them. They were obviously heavy and strained the manipulator to capacity. We pulled the boxes to the opening and called the surface ship and told them to lower some lines with hooks on the ends of them. We attached the lines, stood off, and let the ship winch the stuff up with its superior lifting power. Austin, who had been trained in deep water salvage, nodded.
Exactly the way I would have handled it.
Captain Logan's idea.
Christman smirked with embarrassment.
We were like the British soldiers in that movie, Bridge on the River Kwai. We really got into it.
professional pride, I guess. Don't feel bad. They probably would have killed you if you hadn't done the job. That's what the captain said. We worked round-the-clock shifts. There were a few of the hitches you'd expect with a job that complicated, but we got all the stuff they wanted off the ship. Did you see what was in the steamer trunks? That was a funny thing. They shoved us around the corner, but we could hear them prying the boxes open with a crowbar. They sounded pretty excited. Then there was this silence, and next we heard them yelling. It sounded like an argument. Then Pulaski appeared and started shouting at us in Russian, like whatever happened was our fault. He looked real angry, but I think he was a little scared. Kreisman glanced around the room and got nods of agreement from the other crewmen. No indication what the dust-up was all about? He shook his head. They put us below, and when they brought us on deck again, it was night. The monster sub was back. There was a ship nearby, too. We couldn't see in the dark, but it sounded like a big one. They loaded us aboard the sub, except for the captain and pilot. Same first-class accommodations. We traveled underwater, a shorter time than before. When we were allowed out, we were in a place as big as an airplane hangar. That would be the sub pen. What happened to the NR-1? We don't know. It was still tied up alongside the salvage vessel when we left. The captain and pilot are okay, I hope, he said with consternation. Why would they keep us prisoner and let them go? They may have further work for the NR-1 or simply want hostages. What happened next? They put us in yet another bunk room. A real dump. We were there a couple of days, bored as hell. The only excitement was what sounded like a big explosion from somewhere below. They were sealing the entrance to the subpen. Why would they do that? The base had been discovered, and they wanted to make sure no one would find the evidence. The big sub used in the hijack had served its purpose. I wouldn't be surprised if they planned to plug the surface entrance later. Maybe with you inside. What was the guard situation? Same bunch who kept an eye on us on the salvage ship. Military types with automatic weapons. They gave us black bread and water and locked us in. Next thing we know, these guys with the funny hats and the baggy pants showed up. The first guards were Girl Scouts compared to this gang. They beat up a couple of the guys just for chuckles, dragged us outside, and herded us into that big field. You know the rest. Austin looked around the room. Any questions? Did you get a glimpse of your GPS position when you were on the NR-1? Gunn said. They kept us away from the positioning gauges, then turned them off later so we couldn't see. Damn shame, Gunn said. Laughter rippled around the room. Are we missing a joke? Gunn said. A slim, blonde-haired crewman in his mid-20s stood and identified himself as Seaman Ted McCormick. He passed a sheet of paper toward the table. These are the GPS coordinates for the wreck. How can you be sure? Gunn said, reading the figures. McCormick held out his arm and displayed what looked like an overgrown digital wristwatch. My wife gave this to me. We got married just before I shipped out. She's got a chart back home, so when I called her, she could mark exactly where I was. We used to kid Mac about being on a short leash, Kreisman said. Not anymore. When we were hijacked, I slid this thing up my arm and kept it covered under my sleeve, McCormick said. They never frisked us. Figured we were harmless, I guess. The Protec GPS watch was a miracle of miniaturization, said by its manufacturer to be the world's smallest GPS device. It could give the wearer his position anywhere on the planet within a few yards. Austin grinned. Let's hear it for love. He looked around the room. Now, to quote the immortal words of Porky Pig, that's all, folks. Thanks for your help, and bon voyage.
The NR-1 crew rose to their feet as one and stampeded out of the conference room like thirsty steers who'd smelled water. Austin turned to the Numa team. Paul flipped open his laptop computer and connected it to the modem that would allow files to be projected on a large screen at one end of the room. Ime stood next to the projection screen with a laser pointer. Paul tapped a few keys, and a map of the kidney-shaped Black Sea and the surrounding land appeared.
"Welcome to the Black Sea, one of the most fascinating bodies of water in the world," Gamay said, outlining the shores with the bright red dot. "It's roughly 630 miles from east to west and 330 from north to south. It's only 144 miles here at the waist, where the Crimea sticks out. Despite its relatively small size, it's got a big, bad reputation. The Greeks called it Axenos, which means inhospitable. The medieval Turks were less diplomatic. They named it Karadeniz, the Sea of Death."
"Catchy," Zavala said. "It has a certain poetic quality."
"I can definitely see the Chamber of Commerce using that in a New York Times ad," Austin agreed. Gamay rolled her eyes.
"Are you two ever serious?"
"We try not to be," Austin said. "Sorry to interrupt, teacher. Please go on."
"Thank you. Despite the bad press, the Black Sea gets a lot of visitors. Jason came this way in the original Argo to look for the Golden Fleece. The sea has been an important trade route and fishing ground for thousands of years. During the Ice Age, it was a big freshwater lake. Then around 6000 BC, a natural land dam broke and the waters of the Mediterranean burst through. The sea level rose hundreds of feet."
"Noah's flood," Austin said.
"Some people think so. The people who lived around the lake fled for their lives."
Gamay smiled. "I can't say whether they did it on an ark. The salt water effectively smothered the lake. River nutrients pouring into the sea have only made the situation worse." She signaled to Paul, who projected a profile of the sea onto the screen. "This gives you an idea of the incredible depth. A continental shelf that's probably the remnant of the old shoreline runs around the perimeter. It's the widest off Ukraine. Then it plunges down for 7,000 feet. The thin layer near the top is rich with life, but below the 550-foot mark, there is no oxygen, and the sea is lifeless. It's the biggest body of dead water in the world. Even worse, the depths are loaded with hydrogen sulfide. One breath of this stuff can kill you. If that mass of poison ever rose to the surface, it would release a cloud that would kill every living thing in and around the sea." "The Turks weren't kidding about the Sea of Death," Zavala said.
Paul projected a map that had a dotted line running around the inner edge of the sea. "Kreisman said the ship was found around the 400-foot level. That would put it at the edge of the continental shelf. Any deeper, and the ship wouldn't be there. Wooden vessels are perfectly preserved in the depths because there is no oxygen to sustain wood-boring worms, but the chemicals eat away at metal."
"The ship would have been reduced to its basic molecules," Austin said.
"That's right. That gorge he talked about is probably an extended riverbed. The continental shelf is smooth and gradually dips seaward, pretty much like the ensign's description. The decay from all those organisms has formed pockets of methane gas. Presumably, a diver could be insulated from that type of thing, but there might still be some danger in diving in a poisonous environment."
Gunn had been absorbing the discussion. He rose from his seat and borrowed the laser pointer.
"Let's see what we've got.
The NR-1 was hijacked here."
He ran the red dot from the Aegean through the Bosporus. "This is where they heard sounds of ship traffic." He moved the pointer along the edge of the continental shelf. "Here's our mystery ship, according to the GPS. Using his cursor, Paul drew an X at the location Gunn indicated. Someone went to a great deal of trouble to salvage that ship, Austin said. Maybe it holds the key to unraveling this whole mess. Gunn turned to the captain. How soon can we haul anchor and get moving? Atwood had kept silent throughout the ensign's presentation and the Numa team's discussion. He smiled and said, You people have been so engrossed in the Black Sea, you didn't notice me calling the bridge. We're on our way. Should be on side in the morning. The faint vibration of the engines came through the deck under their feet. Gunn got up. I'm going to hit the sack. Tomorrow could be a long day. Austin got directions to his cabin, then told Joe that he'd catch up with him later. When Austin was alone, he sat at the table and stared at the lines and squiggles of the Black Sea map projected on the screen, as if they were letters of an unknown language whose secret could be unlocked by a Rosetta Stone. His eye fastened on the X that marked the position of the mystery ship. He sorted through the events that had brought him to this place on a Numa vessel in pursuit of... what? He felt like someone making his way through a snake pit, trying to pick out the non-poisonous snakes from the vipers. He snapped off the lights and left the conference room. As he made his way to his cabin, he had a depressing thought. Maybe they were all poisonous. Chapter 20. The gray dawn light streaming through the cabin porthole woke Austin up. He glanced over at Zavala, who was in the next bunk, no doubt lost in a dream world of red corvettes and beautiful blonde statisticians. He envied his partner's ability to drop off to sleep, snooze soundly through the night, and wake up fresh and ready for action. Austin's own slumber had been fitful, disturbed by churning thoughts, as if his brain were searching for answers hidden in the maze of his subconscious. Levering himself out of bed, Austin went over to the sink and splashed cold water on his face. He dressed quickly, pulling on jeans, a heavy sweatshirt, and a windbreaker, and stepped out of the cabin. A cool morning breeze from off the water smacked him in the face and blew away the lingering shreds of sleep. The sun's eyebrow was starting to peek over the eastern horizon, its soft rays bathing the clouds in a reddish-gold light. With the Argo steaming at 15 knots, Austin hung over the railing and stared out at the opaque surface of the sea, listening to the soothing hiss of the waves against the hull. Seabirds skimmed the foam like wind-blown confetti. It was hard to believe that a few hundred feet below was the most lifeless place on the planet. The Black Sea was a big puddle of dead water, but Austin knew that an abyss with far more reason to be feared was the remorseless evil that lurked in the depths of the human mind. Austin shivered, not entirely from the cold, and headed back into the ship. As he stepped through the door into the warmth of the mess hall, the mouth-watering bouquet of coffee, fried eggs, and bacon provided an antidote for his morbid mood, and his spirits improved. Except for the blue sea visible through the windows, the ship's dining area could have been a small-town breakfast hangout, where the locals have coffee mugs with their names on them. Sleepy-eyed crew members coming off the night watch occupied a few tables. Austin grabbed a coffee to go. On his way to the bridge, he encountered the Trouts, who had come down for breakfast earlier and taken a tour of the ship. Together, they climbed up to the wheelhouse, where the wraparound windows gave a wide view of the bow and deck. Rudy Gunn, an early riser going back to his Navy days, stood near a bank of instruments and monitors, talking to Captain Atwood. He smiled broadly when he saw his colleagues. Good morning, everyone. I was about to go looking for you. Captain was going over his plans for the wreck site. Looking forward to hearing them, Austin said. How soon will we be on site? Atwood pointed to a circular gray screen with white concentric circles etched into the glass. Specks of gray indicated the GPS readings from an antenna that picked up information from the network of 24 satellites orbiting the Earth at 11,000 miles. A digital readout next to the screen displayed current latitude and longitude. The system could place the ship within 30 to 45 feet of its target. We should be on site in about 15 minutes if the navigational coordinates from the sub-sailor's Dick Tracy wristwatch are on the mark.
You weren't joking when you said we'd be there first thing this morning, Austin said.
The Argo may look like a workhorse, but she's got racing genes in her blood.
What are your plans for the initial survey?
We'll map out the general area with side-scan sonar using our new UUV, then take a closer look. The crew is down on the deck, getting things ready.
The Unmanned Untethered Vehicle, or UUV, was one of the hottest developments in undersea exploration. Paul asked to see a chart. The captain pushed aside a blue curtain that divided the wheelhouse from the smaller chart room. A map of the Black Sea was spread out on the table.
We're here, Atwood said, putting his finger on a spot off the western shore of the Black Sea.
Trout's tall form bent over the chart.
We're over the edge of a shallow underwater shelf that wraps around the shoreline past Romania and the Danube Delta, the Bosporus, and around to Crimea in the north.
He turned to his wife.
Gimay can fill us in on the biological and archaeological angles.
Gimay took over. The shelf Paul talked about is an incredibly productive fishery. It's home to salmon, beluga sturgeon, turbot. You'll find dolphins there and bonito, although the stocks are down. Some say the Turks have overfished the sea, but they say it's European Union pollution coming from the Danube. What's not in dispute is the fact that below a fluctuating depth of around 450 feet, there is no life. 90% of the sea is sterile. With the fish population down, huge red tides and jellyfish infestations have come in. People are concerned enough to actually start doing something.
That's how NUMA came to be involved, Captain Atwood said. We were collecting information for a joint Russian-Turkish project.
I was wondering why you didn't have representatives from either country aboard, Paul said.
On earlier trips, the government observers spent most of their time telling the ships where they couldn't conduct surveys. Admiral Sandecker insisted on carte blanche when NUMA was asked to lend a hand, which meant no observers on this preliminary survey. Between his prestige and their desperation, he was able to hold his own.
These countries have a good reason to be desperate, Gimay said. The pollution is creating the conditions for a turnover. If the dead water rises to the top, everything in the sea and around the rim could be wiped out.
There's nothing like the threat of extinction to get people off their butts, Gunn remarked.
That would do it for me, Austin said.
Trout drew his finger along the map.
The bottom here will be covered with black mud over clay that marks the change of the ancient lake to a sea.
When you get beyond the edge of the shelf, we find deep submarine canyons carved into the steep shelf slope. 10,000 years ago, the sea level was 1,000 feet lower than it is now. The flood theory suggests that 60,000 square miles were inundated by the waters of the Mediterranean.
Which made anyone with a boat very popular, Austin said.
Gimay said, this deals directly with our situation. As Paul explained last night, shipworms can't survive in the deep water, so wooden wrecks will be perfectly preserved for thousands of years, and steel ships will disintegrate.
A crewman called the captain into the wheelhouse. Atwood excused himself. A minute later he returned, his face wreathed in a wide grin.
We're on target. Our mystery ship should be right below our radio antenna.
Gunn said, remind me to send a bouquet of flowers to the young woman who gave her sailor boy a GPS watch.
Austin looked out at the sea stretching to the horizon and thought of the wasted time that could have been spent in a fruitless search for the ship.
I've got a better idea, Austin said. Let's send her a whole greenhouse.
Zavala arrived and they went down to the starboard deck, where sunlight gleamed off the metal skin of a small torpedo that rested in an aluminum rack. The tall man disconnecting a computer modem attached to the device was Mark Murphy, the Argo's expert in remote-operated undersea vehicles.
Murphy was a nonconformist who scorned the Pneuma work coveralls for his own uniform. Faded jean cutoffs, chamois shirt worn over a t-shirt, scuffed work boots, and a short-billed baseball cap. Both his cap and t-shirt had the word Argonaut printed on them. He was in his early 50s, and a thick salt-and-pepper beard covered his chin, but his ruddy, sunburned face glowed with boyish enthusiasm. He saw Zavala gazing at the torpedo and said, "Be my guest."
"Thanks."
Zavala ran his fingertips lightly over the wide stripes of green, yellow, and black painted on the metal skin.
"Sexy," he said with a low whistle.
"Very sexy." "You'll have to excuse my friend," Austin said. "He hasn't had shore leave for at least 24 hours.
"I understand perfectly," Murphy replied. "This baby is hot. Wait till you see the way she performs."
Austin was amused, but not surprised to hear the two men fawn over the device. Zavala was a brilliant marine engineer who had designed or directed construction of many underwater vehicles. Murphy was the Argo's expert in their use. To them, the clean lines of the compact object cradled in its aluminum rack were as sensual as the curves of the female body. Austin could understand their passion. The UUV was only 62 inches long, 7.5 inches in diameter, and weighed a mere 80 pounds. But the bantam-sized device represented the cutting edge of undersea exploration, a vehicle that could operate almost independently of its shipboard controllers. This model was developed by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which had dubbed it SAHRV, for Semi-Autonomous Hydrographic Reconnaissance Vehicle.
"We're about ready to launch," Murphy said. "We've dropped two separate transducers over the side, one at each corner of the survey area. That sets up the navigation on that. The vehicle talks constantly with the transducers that tell it where it is at all times. The data she picks up will be recorded on a hard drive and downloaded later."
"Why not telemeter the information directly back to the ship?" Austin asked.
"We could, but the data would take too long to make it through the water. I've told the vehicle to survey 10 100-foot lanes at high resolution for a start. She'll run at 5.5 knots around 90 feet off the bottom. The collision avoidance sonar will make sure she goes over or around any big obstacles."
Murphy reached over and pressed a magnetic switch on the side of the vehicle. The battery-powered stainless steel propeller whirred softly. With the help of another crewman, Murphy gently lowered the rack into the water. The Argo bristled with an amazing array of winches and cranes to handle the variety of electronic eyes and ears and hands, manned and unmanned submersibles the scientists on board dropped into the ocean. One crane, so powerful it could lift a house, also had weak links that would deliberately break under undue stress. That was to prevent them from sinking in case the ship hooked onto an undersea mountain. Most of the heavy equipment was lowered through the moon pool, a center section of the Argo's hull that opened to the sea through huge sliding doors. With the UUV, however, it was only a matter of lowering it over the side. The propeller grabbed water and the vehicle took off like a fish released from a hook. It headed away from the ship and arced into a pre-programmed 30-foot circle when it hit open sea. "She'll go around four times to calibrate the compass," Murphy explained. "The vehicle is talking to the navigational net now, getting its bearings through triangulation." As they watched, the vehicle made a final circle and disappeared below the surface. "She's heading off to do her first lane."
"What do we do now?" Austin said.
Murphy gave them his big-toothed grin.
"We go have some coffee and donuts."
Chapter 21. The undersea vehicle moved back and forth above the ocean floor in a lawn-mowing pattern, its path on the ocean floor displayed on the computer screen. When its task was finished, the UUV homed in on a third transducer, like a puppy who'd heard the word bone. The vehicle nosed up to the side of the ship, where it was snagged in a special pickup rack and lifted back on deck.
Murphy hooked up a modem and transferred all the data from the dripping vehicle to his laptop computer. Then he disconnected the computer. Tucking the laptop under his arm, Murphy led the way to the conference room, where he set the laptop down on a table and connected it to a large screen monitor. The computer's CSON software began to generate high-resolution sonar images in slow motion onto the screen, and the pictures of the seafloor as recorded by the UUV flowed down from the top of the monitor like twin waterfalls. Latitude, longitude, and position were displayed to the right of the screen. Murphy adjusted the screen's color control to a yellow-brown that was easy on the eyes. The seafloor was largely unmarked. Occasionally a boulder showed up, or dark and light patches indicated differences in sediment. Halfway through its fourth track, the sonar caught two straight lines joined at an angle. All eyes were focused on the monitor as the vehicle finished the track, turned, and came back. Murphy froze the picture. "Bingo," he said. The unmistakable image of a ship stood out in sharp relief. With a click of the computer mouse, Murphy zoomed in the picture. The darks and lights became doors, hatches, and portholes. The computer compiled the ship's measurements. "She's 250 feet long," Murphy said. Austin pointed to a shadow on the hull. "Can you zoom in on that section?" Murphy obliged with a click of the mouse, and the section Austin had noticed appeared as a small box to one side of the screen. The scientist played around with the resolution until the hole in the side of the hull near the waterline was clearly visible. He ran off a full-color copy of the survey area, showing the target hits, and spread it out on a table. "She's at 450 feet," he said. "Here's where the 300-foot bottom begins to fall away into a canyon. The ship is on a slope, just past the lip of the cut. We're lucky. A few hundred feet farther and the wreck would have been lost forever from metal deterioration." "Good job, Murphy," Captain Atwood said. Turning to the others, he said, "I've got a crew ready to launch an ROV from the moon pool." A robotic vehicle. They all moved to a small room that contained the control consoles for vehicles operating out of the moon pool. Gesturing toward a computer console, the captain said to Gunn, "Would you care to handle the controls, Commander?" Gunn's academic demeanor cloaked a personality that enjoyed action, and he had been chafing in his role as a bystander since boarding the ship. He was an experienced hand at running an ROV and needed no prodding. "I'd like that very much. Thank you, Captain." "Whenever you're ready." Gunn sat behind the control console and familiarized himself with the instruments and the feel of the joystick that controlled the ROV. Then he grinned and rubbed his hands together. "Drop her in." The captain unclipped a small radio from his belt and gave a command. A moment later, the screen flickered to life and projected a view of the cavernous moon pool through the video camera in the nose of the ROV. The camera seemed to flood as the ROV was lowered into the pool. A diver wearing a wetsuit came into view as he uncoupled the line attached to the lifting crane. Then he was gone, replaced by a cloud of bubbles and the deepening blue of the sea, as the ROV sank slowly beneath the open bottom of the ship. A 1,000-foot Kevlar-jacketed tether connected the Benthos Stingray ROV to the ship. The tether transmitted Gunn's commands to the operating system and relayed the video picture back to the screen. The Argo carried larger and more powerful ROVs, but after hearing the NR-1 story, the captain had thought they would need a smaller vehicle that could be maneuvered into tight spaces. The vehicle was the size and shape of a large suitcase. Although the ROV was relatively small, it carried video and digital cameras and a manipulator arm. Moving the joystick with a skilled hand, Gunn angled the ROV into a long dive. The vehicle used the navigational net established for the UUV to find its way directly to the target. Color faded from the water as each descending fathom took the ROV farther from the dappled surface light. Gunn switched on the twin 150-watt quartz halogen lights, but even their powerful beams were swallowed by the thickening gloom. The ROV smoothly descended to 300 feet,
then leveled out a few yards above the ocean floor. The vehicle bucked a slight bottom current that kept its speed under a knot as it moved forward above the black mud. Then the bottom dropped away, and the ROV soared over the lip of the undersea canyon so suddenly that everyone in the room felt a slight wave of queasiness. Gunn nosed the ROV downward, keeping the vehicle parallel to the sharp slope. The ROV's side-scan sonar painted the target on a separate monitor until it was close enough for visual inspection. Gunn goosed the vertical thrusters and the vehicle rose slowly above the vessel. The ship lay at an angle on the sloping side of the canyon, the bottom section of hull embedded in mud. The ROV descended several yards and moved alongside the hulk at main deck level, past a row of portholes, including some that were still open. Barnacles covered most of the ship and heightened its spectral aspect. Reddish patches of anti-fouling paint peeked out here and there. The wooden wheelhouse had disintegrated and the decks had rotted away. The lifeboat davits were empty, and wire shrouds hung with seaweed. A pile of rusty debris was all that remained of the collapsed funnel. The ship was a metal cadaver, useless except for the schools of fish that nosed through passageways where humans had once walked. To Austin, who watched the screen with an expression of fascination on his bronzed features, this sad and lifeless hunk of rusty metal was a living thing. Although there were no hands to close the hatches forced open by the pressure of escaping air, Austin could almost hear the creak of the booms and the throbbing engine as the ship plowed through the seas. In his mind's eye, he pictured the helmsman standing with feet braced on a wooden grating, hands on the wheel while crewmen went about their business on deck or fought the inevitable boredom of shipboard life. Austin asked Gunn to steer the ROV around to the stern. As Ensign Kreisman described it, the hull was covered with growth that hid the ship's markings. Gunn poked the vehicle into several nooks and crannies, hoping to come across a manufacturer's metal plate, but they found nothing. Austin turned to Gamay. "What's our resident nautical archaeologist have to say about this old gal?" Gamay pinched her chin in thought as she stared at the ghostly images on the glowing screen. "My specialty was Greek and Roman wooden ships, and if you asked me to ID a bireme or a trireme, I might be of more help. I'll venture a few guesses, though." The camera was moving along the midships section, where the rusty steel plating had buckled and was clear of barnacles. "Those are riveted steel plates. By the 1940s, shipbuilders had switched to welding. The booms indicate that she's probably a cargo ship. She's an old-timer, judging from her lines, maybe built in the late 1800s or around the turn of the century." Austin asked Gunn to move the ROV around to the damaged side. The ship leaned downhill, and from this angle it looked as if it could come crashing over at any second. Gunn brought the ROV straight in until the hole filled almost the entire screen. The lights probing the ship's innards picked out twisted pipes and steel columns. "Damage assessment, Rudy," Austin said. "From the way those edges are curled, I'd say a projectile hit the engine room. Too high for a torpedo. Probably a shell from a big gun." "Who would sink a harmless old freighter?" Zavala asked. "Maybe someone who thought she wasn't so harmless," Austin said. "Let's check out the cabin section that Ensign Kreisman told us about." Gunn tweaked the controls and the ROV rose above decks. It was clear from the grin on his face that Rudy was having a ball. He brought the vehicle around, taking care not to catch the tether in the foremast or booms. The ROV moved past the bridge, then stopped and hovered in front of a dark, rectangular opening. Unlike the ragged cavity in the hull, the edges of the hole were relatively even from the cutting torch. Gunn brought the ROV to within a few feet of the opening. The lights picked out the framework of a bunk and the remnants of a metal chair and desk that lay in a tumbled heap. "Can we go inside?" Austin asked.
I'm getting a side current that could make things tricky, but I'll see what I can do.
Gunn maneuvered the vehicle left and right. Then when it was directly centered, he put it through the hole as easily as a seamstress threading a needle. The ROV was capable of turning within its own radius, and Gunn executed a 360-degree turn. The camera captured slimy gray piles of debris. Gunn probed a corner with the ROV's manipulator, stirring up a powdery cloud of rust. Then the ROV got tangled and wouldn't move. Gunn waited for the dust to settle and wriggled the ROV until it broke free of the overhead wire that had snagged a projection of its protective shielding.
"What do you think?" Gunn said, turning to Austin. "I think anything of value has been removed. We'll have to piece together the story from the ship itself, not what's in it."
He pointed to a wall shelf.
"What's that?"
Austin's sharp eye had caught a dark, squarish object. Gunn used the manipulator to clear away a pile of amorphous, grayish-brown trash and made several fruitless attempts to grab the object. It kept slipping away like a prize in a penny arcade game. Gunn set his jaw in determination and pushed the object into a corner where he could get a firm grasp on it. Then he backed the ROV out of the cabin and moved the manipulator to put the prize directly in front of the lights. The claw clutched a small, flat box.
"I'm bringing her up," he said.
He reversed the ROV's direction and sent the vehicle scuttling back to the Argo. Minutes later, the lights of the moon pool appeared on the screen. The captain ordered the ROV's handlers to stabilize the artifact in seawater and send it to the vehicle control room. Soon a technician arrived carrying a white plastic bucket. Gamay, whose background in nautical archaeology made her the most experienced conservator on board, asked for a soft brush. She removed the box from the bucket and gently placed it on the floor. Then, with soft strokes, she brushed a thumbnail patch of the black patina to reveal the gleam of metal.
"It's made of silver," she said, and continued to work until 50% of the top was cleaned. The metal was embossed with a double-headed eagle.
Gamay examined the clasp.
"I might be able to get this open, but I don't dare because I could destroy what's inside when it hits air. It may need intense conservation."
She glanced at the captain.
"The Argo is primarily set up for biological and geological survey," Atwood said. "There's another Numa ship called the Sea Hunter doing archaeological work not far from here. They might be able to help."
"I'm sure they can. I did some research on the Sea Hunter a couple of years ago," Austin said.
"She's the sister ship of the Argo, isn't she?"
"That's right. The two vessels are almost identical."
"We should get this box there soon," Gamay said. "I'll stabilize it in seawater as best I can."
She glanced with longing at the box.
"Damn. Now I'm really curious about the contents."
"How about running it through the X-ray machine in the infirmary?" Austin suggested.
"That might partially satisfy your curiosity."
Gamay carefully replaced the box in the bucket, and the technician carried it off.
"You're brilliant," she said.
"You may not think so after you hear my next idea," Austin replied. He outlined his plan.
"Worth a try," Atwood said, and clicked on his hand radio. Before long, the screen flickered into life and the moon pool appeared again. The ROV was being put back into the water. The dive was a repeat of the first, with the diver, bubbling foam, and dark water. Gunn put the ROV on a direct trajectory to the wreck. Before long, the vehicle was coming from behind the ship. Gunn worked the joystick, and the mechanical arm unfolded and extended to where it could clearly be seen in the glare of the halogen lights. Watching Gamay clean the artifact had given Austin the idea. Clasped in the metal claw was a metal bristled brush used in preparing the Argo's hull for painting. The ROV made several attempts to clear away the barnacles. Newton's law of action causing reaction kicked in, and the brushing pushed the ROV away from the hull. The ship did not want to give up its identity without a fight.
After 45 minutes, they had succeeded in clearing away a patch about a foot in diameter. A portion of a letter embossed in white was visible. It could have been an O, or any of several other letters.
"So much for brilliant ideas," Austin said.
Gunn was equally frustrated. His forehead glistened with beads of perspiration. He'd been trying to counteract the push by revving up the ROV's thrusters. At one point, he lost control and the ROV slammed into the hull. A layer of gunk, a couple of feet across, dropped off to reveal an S.
"There's concretion under the marine growth," Gamay said. "That's why you can't brush this stuff away."
"Can you bang off another chunk?" Austin asked. He turned to the captain.
"With your permission, of course."
Atwood shrugged.
"Hell, I'm as curious about this old hulk as you are. If it takes a few dents and a piece of Pneuma equipment to do the job, let's do it."
His face flushed as he remembered that Pneuma's second-in-command was sitting at the controls. But Gunn had no compunctions. He gritted his teeth and rammed the ship again and again as if he were trying to break down a castle door. Pieces of thin, brittle concretion began to flake off to reveal more letters. After one sharp jab, a huge piece of the covering dropped off to reveal the ship's name in Cyrillic letters. Austin studied the letters illuminated in the glare of the ROV's lights and shook his head.
"My Russian is rusty, but the name of the ship seems to be Odessa Star."
"Doesn't ring a bell," Atwood said. "Have you ever heard of her?"
"Nope," Austin said. "But I'll bet I know somebody who has."
Chapter 22. Washington, D.C. St. Julian Perlmutter had spent most of his day researching a twin-hulled Civil War ironclad for the Smithsonian Institution, and the work had made him hungry. But then, practically everything made Perlmutter hungry. An ordinary human faced with this state of affairs would have satisfied his needs by slapping a wad of cold cuts between two slabs of bread. Not so Perlmutter. He indulged his addiction for German cooking with a plate of pig's knuckles and sauerkraut, paired with a light-bodied Riesling cabinet plucked from his 4,000-bottle wine cellar. He dined using silver and china from the French liner Normandy. He was sublimely happy. The mood persisted even when his telephone gave off a ring like a ship's bell. He patted his mouth and thick gray beard with a monogrammed linen napkin and reached with a plump hand for the phone.
"St. Julian Perlmutter here," he said pleasantly. "State your business in a brief manner."
"I'm sorry, I must have the wrong number," the voice on the phone said. "The gentleman I'm trying to reach would never answer the phone so politely."
"Aha!" Perlmutter's voice ratcheted up the decibel scale to a supersonic boom. "You should be sorry, Kurt. What happened to Imam?"
"Can't say I know anyone by that name. Have you tried Istanbul missing persons?"
"Don't toy with me over such an important matter, you impertinent young snit," Perlmutter boomed, his sky-blue eyes twinkling in the ruddy face. "You know perfectly well you promised to get me an authentic recipe for Imam Baidi, translated loosely as the Imam fainted because the old boy was overcome with delight when he tasted the dish. You did remember, didn't you?"
Austin kept on Perlmutter's good side by searching out authentic recipes on his travels around the world.
"Of course I remembered. I've been trying to persuade one of the finest chefs in Istanbul to part with his recipe, and will send it to you forthwith. I wouldn't want you to waste away to nothing."
Perlmutter roared with laughter, the belly laugh amplified by the nearly 400 pounds of flesh adhering to his sturdy frame.
"There's not much danger of that happening. Are you still in Turkey?"
"In the neighborhood. I'm on a Pneuma ship in the Black Sea."
"Still on your vacation cruise?"
"Vacation's over. I'm back at work and need a favor. Could you dig up something on an old cargo ship named the Odessa Star? It went down in the Black Sea, but I don't know when.
That's all I can tell you for now.
Tracking down your ship should be no problem, not with such a helpful description, Perlmutter responded with dry humor. Please tell me what you do know about it. Perlmutter jotted down the sparse information Austin was able to give.
I'll do my best, although I may be weak with hunger, a condition easily remedied by the receipt of a certain Turkish recipe.
Austin again assured Perlmutter that the recipe was in the pipeline and hung up. He felt guilty for shading the truth somewhat. With all that was going on, he had forgotten Perlmutter's request. He turned to Captain Atwood.
Does anybody in the galley know anything about Turkish cooking?
While Austin tried to track down the imam, thousands of miles away, in his N Street carriage house behind two vine-encrusted Georgetown townhouses, Perlmutter was grinning with pleasure. Despite his bluster, he enjoyed a challenge. The Smithsonian would have to wait, although the concept of an obscure twin-hulled ironclad was intriguing. He glanced around the huge combination living room, bedroom, and study at the stacks of books occupying every square inch. Although the space looked like a librarian's nightmare, Perlmutter's apartment contained the finest collection of historical ship literature ever assembled. Perlmutter had read every volume he owned at least twice. His encyclopedic mind had absorbed a numbing number of facts, each connected like the links of a website to related caches. He could pluck a book from a dusty pile, run his finger down the spine, and remember practically every page. He knitted his brow in thought. Something was eluding him, lurking in a shadowed corner of his mind beyond the periphery of consciousness. He was sure he'd heard of the Odessa Star before Austin mentioned it. He would find it in 5 minutes, or not at all. He dug through his piles of books and periodicals, mumbling under his breath. Damned if he could remember. Must be getting old. He rummaged for an hour before giving up. He picked a card out of his telephone number file and dialed the international code for London and a number. A moment later, a clipped British accent answered, Guildhall Library. Perlmutter gave his name and asked for an assistant cataloger he had dealt with on previous calls. Like many English institutions, the Guildhall Library had been around for centuries. The original library dated back to 1423 and was acknowledged worldwide for a history collection that went back to the 11th century. The library also had the finest collection of wine and food books in the United Kingdom, a fact that had not escaped Perlmutter's attention. But it was the Guildhall's extensive maritime records that Perlmutter often drew upon in his research. England's naval tradition, and the wide reach of the British Empire colonies and trade, made the collection a treasure trove of information about practically every sea-girt country in the world. The cataloger, a pleasant young woman named Elizabeth Bosworth, came on the line.
Julian, how nice to hear from you again.
Thank you, Elizabeth. All goes well with you, I trust?
Very well, thank you. I've been quite busy indexing agreements of colonial registered vessels dating back to the 1700s.
I hope I'm not calling it a bad time.
Of course not, Julian. The material is fascinating, but the work does get a bit tedious at times. What can I do for you?
I'm trying to track down some information on an old cargo ship named the Odessa Star, and wondered if you could tickle the Lloyd's file for me. The Guildhall Library held all the shipping records for the giant international marine insurance underwriter prior to 1985. Lloyd's of London had been established in 1811 to provide a universal system of intelligence and superintendence in all the principal ports of the world. To accomplish this goal, Lloyd's had set up a network of agents. By the turn of the century, the agency had more than 400 agents and 500 sub-agents scattered around the globe. Their reports on marine casualties, ship owners, shipping movements, and voyages were contained in the library's files, where they were accessible to historians like Perlmutter.
"I'd be happy to look into it for you," Bosworth replied.
Her enthusiasm was due only in part to the generous contributions, far and above the usual research fee, that Perlmutter consistently made to the library. She shared his love of sea history and admired his book collection. More than once, she had gone to him with queries of her own. Apologizing for providing so little information, Perlmutter relayed the facts outlined by Austin. Bosworth said she would get back to him as soon as she could. Perlmutter hung up and returned to his research for the Smithsonian. With bulldog perseverance, he unearthed a rough sketch of the Confederate twin-hulled ironclad and was typing out a report on his computer when the phone rang. It was Bosworth.
"Julian, I've found some references to the Odessa Star. I'll fax them to you."
"Thank you so much, Elizabeth. In return, the next time I'm in town, I'll take you to lunch at Simpson's on the Strand."
"It's a date," she said. "You know where to find me."
They said their goodbyes, and a minute later, the fax buzzed and spat out several sheets of paper. Perlmutter examined the top sheet. It was a report of the Lloyd's agent in Novorossiysk, a Mr. A. Zubrin. It was dated April of 1917. "This is to report that the Odessa Star, freighter of 10,000 tons, carrying a cargo of coal from Caucasus en route from Odessa to Constantinople, 1917 February, did not arrive at its destination and is presumed lost. Have confirmed such with G. Bozdag, Lloyd's agent, Constantinople. No report of ship at any Black Sea port. Vessel owned by Fauché Limited of Marseille, France, which has put in a claim. Last survey, June 1916, showed ship in desperate need of repair. Please advise as to claim." The other papers included a three-way correspondence among the agent, the central office in London, and the French owners. The French were insisting on full payment of the claim. Lloyd's resisted, citing the perilous condition of the ship, but eventually settled for a third, most of it the value of the cargo. Perlmutter turned to a ceiling-to-floor bookcase and extracted a thick volume, whose burgundy cloth cover was worn with use. He leafed through the registry of French shipping companies. Fauché had gone out of business in 1922. Perlmutter grunted. Small wonder, the way they neglected their ships. He replaced the registry and picked up another document Bosworth had sent him. It was a copy of a book review from the London Times dating to the 30s. The headline read, "Veteran Sea Captain Reveals Secrets of the Black Sea." He put the review aside and turned to the note from Bosworth. "Dear Julian, hope this material is of help. I found a reference to your mystery ship in a summary of archival material bequeathed to the library by the estate of Lord Dodson, who served for many years in the Foreign Office. It was a manuscript containing Dodson's memoirs, but it seems to have been withdrawn by the family. There was also mention of the Odessa Star in a book called Life on the Black Sea. We have a copy here, and I can FedEx it to you if you wish.